Rav Yosef Karo, in Legends and Lessons, this is perhaps, if you had to give sort of a top five, top ten list of post-biblical era characters who have made the most influence on Judaism. So one of them might be in the running, might be Rav Yosef Karo. Because Rav Yosef Karo, as we know, writes what ultimately becomes the Shulchan Aruch. But before we get there, we have to understand what led to him creating that. But what we know of as the Shulchan Aruch today is basically has influenced and informs everything we do. You know, anything that ever comes up. You know, I mean, multiple times a day. Today, I probably looked at the Shulchan Aruch three times. People ask me questions, I'm looking into different ideas, right? You just, everything you need to know, you look at the Shulchan Aruch. And if it's not the Shulchan Aruch, so you look at a tshuva, which is using the Shulchan Aruch. Or you're looking at the Mishnah Berurah, which is on the Shulchan Aruch. You're looking at the Prima Gadim, which is not, everything's on the Shulchan Aruch. Everything revolves around the commentary on the body of law, which teaches us what to do. And therefore, one could make the case that Rav Yosef Karo, who we're talking about tonight, is perhaps one of the most influential characters in Jewish history, at least the Jewish history that we're up to now. You know, if you ask somebody earlier, so maybe it wouldn't be the same. Even if you ask somebody in the 16th or 17th century, where the Shulchan Aruch had not yet gained the same kind of momentum it has now, because it didn't have as many commentaries and as many tshuvas that are written about Shulchan Aruch, so maybe the idea would be different. But nowadays, we have a Shulchan Aruch, we basically live based on the Shulchan Aruch. Either the Shulchan Aruch or its commentaries. So in order to really understand the gravity of this person, Rav Yosef Karo, let's understand a little bit of where he came from. Rav Yosef Karo was born in 1488 in Spain. Now that might trigger some interesting connections for people. Spain in 1488 was not a good place for the Jews. The entire 15th century was not a good place for the Jews. And it is only 4 years later, as we know, that not only did Christopher Columbus sail the ocean blue, but also the Jews got kicked out of Spain. Right? The same exact time. Rav Yosef Karo is born into Jewish persecution. He's born into Spain 4 years before the Jews are kicked out. And then after he's kicked out, his family moves to Portugal. And as you know, there's a very strong connection at that time historically between Portugal and Spain politically. And therefore, 5 years after that, they get kicked out of Portugal. Right? So the first 10 years of Rav Yosef Karo's life has basically, you know, you can just chalk it up to persecution. And in some ways, keep that in the back of your mind, because when we talk about how Rav Yosef Karo dedicated his life to writing down the law and making sure that people know and everyone's on the same page, he's coming at it from this perspective where he grows up, where there is a lack of order and a lack of organization, a lack of commonality, because everybody's moving all over the world. And there are maps you can look up, maps that show how far and wide the Jewish people left from Spain to different places, and how much it really influenced the rest of the Jewish world because of this historical moment. So he's born into this moment. He's born into a life of persecution and expulsion. So when he's 4 years old, he moves to Portugal. When he's 9 years old, 9 years old in 1497, they're kicked out of Portugal, and then they wander a little bit. They wander a little bit, and they end up somewhere else in the Ottoman Empire, in a place that we now call Bulgaria, but at that point was called Nicopol. And over there he stayed for about 20 years. And as you can imagine, there wasn't a vast Jewish community or a long-standing established Jewish community in this little place in Bulgaria. But nonetheless, he had his father and he had his uncle, and that was enough. His father was a very astute Talmud Chacham. His uncle Yitzchak was a very astute Talmud Chacham. And he marries, he has kids. Unfortunately, we don't know much about his kids or his wives. But he ends up, we know he has three wives based on the fact that he mentions three father-in-laws at some point. But we don't know exactly what happened to them. We assume that they probably died, because three of his kids also died. You can imagine when it comes from, when this is just my theorizing. When you're going from place to place and you're not used to the climate or the general immunities, you know, this is how we're thinking nowadays. If you're not used to the general immunities of other countries, so it could be a risk in someone's health, and therefore one could maybe surmise that some of these health issues, whether it's his children or his wives, were due to all the constant moving around. Now, the truth is that people know Rav Yosef Karo mostly for what he ends up being as the rabbi of Tzfat, right? But that's much later in his life. It's actually not part of his formidable years. His formidable years are basically on the road in this place called Nicopol, in the Turkish region, still under the Ottoman Empire. Now, he meets a few different people along this path. Perhaps one of the strangest connections that he has is to a person named Shlomo Malcho. Anyone familiar with Shlomo Malcho? Shlomo Malcho was one of the lesser known false messiahs. Just trying to bring him up here. I saw, let me see if I can find him quickly here. Rabbi Shlomo Malcho. It's good to have another computer around. Shlomo Malcho was, his original name was Diogo Perez, was a Portuguese Jewish mystic and pseudo messiah. He ended up getting burned at the stake because he tried to convince one of the Roman emperors to create a Jewish army, which apparently wasn't a good idea, so they killed him. Kind of crazy story. He has a very ornate signature, according to Wikipedia. This is how he used to sign his stuff. You have to decipher it. There's like a flag in there, and there looks like some fancy calligraphy underneath it. I have no idea, but either way, he only lived until he was 32, but he was one of these pseudo messiahs that that Rav Yosef Karo actually connects to, and it's unclear to what extent their connection was, because we don't really have a lot about, especially because of all his traveling, all of his expulsions, we don't have a lot about Rav Yosef Karo's personal life. As I already mentioned about his family's the family information, we don't really know a lot, but apparently he had some kind of affinity towards Shlomo Malcho, specifically on the Kabbalistic realm, which, although Rav Yosef Karo was very analytical and very, I guess, astute in a law perspective, meaning to concretize and to codify law, you have to really be, you know, a rational intellectual type. But nonetheless, he had this whole spiritual Kabbalistic mysticism type side of him, which we'll get to later. Basically, when he's in his 40s at some point, again, difficult to really figure it out, when he's in his 40s, he ends up going to Tzfat. Now, by the time he gets to Tzfat, we have to take a little bit of a backtrack. It's unclear when these things happened specifically, but he wrote already, now let's see, he was born in 1488, that means that by 1530... he's in Tzfat, let's say 1530. At that point, he had already written, so we don't really know when the Beis Yosef was written, but he had already written the Beis Yosef, and before he wrote the Beis Yosef, he wrote the Kesef Mishnah. So for this, we have to take a little bit of a backtrack, and we'll get back to some of this in more detail later. But Rav Yosef Karo, potentially, as I said before, influenced by the fact that there's a lack of organization in terms of Torah Sheba'al Peh, or specifically halacha, the Jewish law, because there's lack in organization, feels the need to give a little more clarity for people when it comes to Jewish law and Jewish practice. What he does, basically, is, one could say, he ultimately becomes the modern-day Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. What do I mean by that? Ultimately, originally, Hashem gave us the Torah, and he gave us the Torah Shebechsav, he gave us the Torah Shebaal Peh. There was an oral Torah that Hashem gave us, which includes a whole bunch of different types of things, the traditions of the halacha, and the explanations of the halacha, and the tools of figuring out halachas. And ultimately what happens, the Jews start to be dispersed. The Jews start to scatter all around the world after the exile of the Second Temple. And what they basically have to do is somehow keep it all together. Right, the Gemara tells us that Es la hasos la Hashem heferus harasecha. It became a time where there was a great need for the Jewish people. And even though it says typically that you're not allowed to write down the oral Torah, which is why it's called the oral Torah, even though you're not allowed to write it down, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi said, I have to write it down. Because if I don't write it down, we're going to lose it. What good is an oral Torah if no one knows what to say and no one knows what to hear and to learn? So what he does is he writes down a concise, sort of a concise breakdown of all the halachas, which is why when you read the Mishnah, which is what he called it, when you read the Mishnah, oftentimes it's very concise and very basic. It doesn't go through a lot of detail, and it's not the point of it wasn't details. It was supposed to be a memory trigger. When we say Mishnah, what we really mean is a concise breakdown of Jewish law. It doesn't give much explanation. It doesn't give many sources. It's just the law. The Gemara later on was written down by Ravina and Ravashi, or compiled by Ravina and Ravashi, to do the exact same thing because we kept forgetting the explanations of the Mishnah. The Mishnah was supposed to be that memory trigger. It didn't work, or at least didn't work in the long term. So Ravina and Ravashi write down the Gemara as a way to remember all the explanations of the Mishnah. That's what we now have as the Gemara. Rabbi Yosef Cairo is thinking of doing the same exact thing, but in a different way. So basically, Rabbi Yosef Cairo wasn't the first person to do this. After the Gemara, so there start to be codifiers. Now, why do you have to codify the Gemara? Because the Gemara, as Ravina and Ravashi presented it, was a bunch of discussions of how to explain the Mishnah. So when you're trying to explain the Mishnah, there are different ways you can explain it. The problem then becomes, you're getting so far afield with all the explanations, you forget which explanation we actually follow. Right? You were so entrenched in figuring out the back and forth, so which one do we actually follow? Do we follow this opinion or that opinion? So ultimately, we have to have codifiers. So one of the first codifiers' name was Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, and this is going to be important later on for what Rav Yosef Cairo does. One of the first codifiers was Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. Rav Yitzchak Alfasi was in about the 1000 to 1100 time, so maybe a little earlier. And he basically takes the Gemara and he shrinks it. How does he shrink it? He takes out all the discussion and he just gives you the bottom line. The conclusion of this Gemara is like this. This is the bottom line. This is the Jewish law that we're supposed to learn from this Gemara. Basically, if you can think of it like a, I don't know, it's sort of like an expansion and a contraction, right? So when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi took the oral Torah, he contracted it into a very concise law. Then the Gemara comes along and expands it into all this discussion. The Rif comes back and says, okay, this is the concise law, right? Back to the concise law so we know what we're doing. So that's what the Rif did. He just cut away a lot of the discussion. The Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel, another very important rabbi in the 13th century, from Germany, ultimately ends up in Spain also because of persecution. He does a similar thing as the Rif, and he also sort of cuts away the other conversation, tells us the bottom line. The one person, and we've talked about this, the one person who deviates from that method and creates a new codification with a new type of categorization or a new type of organization was the Rambam, Maimonides. We talked about him a couple months ago. The Rambam doesn't base his codification on the Gemara. I mean, he bases it on the statements of the Gemara, but he creates a new system called the Yud Dalid, the Yad Chazaka is what he calls it, the Mishnah Torah. Now, that Mishnah Torah was, as we talked about a couple of months ago, very, very concise, very, very specific and organized and meticulous in its wording. We've talked about this, especially in our Wednesday night class for the ladies. The Mishnah Torah, therefore, had a couple of downsides to it. And the Rambam received a lot of criticism. We've talked about this also. He received a lot of criticism specifically because, at least mostly because, the halachos that he wrote down didn't have any sources. The Rambam was obviously looking at the conversations of the Gemara, and the language that he uses is clearly borrowed from the Gemara, but much of his sourcing is left for the imagination. He doesn't tell us where he gets some things. And there are some commentaries that are basically, left up a creek without a paddle. Like, how did the Rambam come up with this? Right? Sometimes you'll find the Rambam says something and we have no idea where he got it from. Some commentaries say he got it from his own intuition. Some commentaries dig up some way off midrashim that we don't even know the Rambam had, but sounds like he has. Right? So every single statement from the Rambam is very much analyzed and sometimes criticized for its sourcing. Comes along Rabbi Yosef Kairo. Rabbi Yosef Kairo, who is in his own right pretty Sephardi, right? So if we're thinking about the Sephardic rabbis, so the Rif that we mentioned, Northern Africa, definitely Sephardi. The Rush that we mentioned from Germany originally, ultimately to Spain, mostly Ashkenazi. Let's call him mostly Ashkenazi, though he ends his life in Sephardi land. And then we talked about the Rambam. The Rambam, Spain, Egypt, very Sephardi. Rabbi Yosef Kairo comes along, coming from Spain and Portugal and Turkey, now in Israel, also pretty Sephardi. So when Rabbi Yosef Kairo comes along, what his perspective basically is, I'm going to justify and explain the Sephardi way of law. Now, there wasn't such a distinction at the time. We'll get to when it comes to a distinction. But at the time, what he first thought of doing was to explain the Rambam. One can understand Rabbi Yosef Kairo's role originally, before the Shulchan Aruch. His role originally was to be a bridge. What do I mean by bridge? What he did was he bridged the Gemara to the Rambam, right? Whereas the Rambam didn't give sources and didn't really give explanations, didn't give his analysis, the Rabbi Yosef Kairo comes along and says, this is how the Rambam got to what he thought. This is how the Rambam, he got it from this Gemara, and this is how he explained that Gemara, and that's why he says what he says. And many times he's defending the Rambam against from criticisms of the Raibid, who was sort of Ashkenazi, sort of Sephardi, from the criticisms of the Ramban, or you know the Magid Mishnah, different people. Yosef Kairo was always trying to add in that background for the people who didn't like the Rambam's lack of sources and explanation. Rabbi Yosef Kairo then goes a step further, and he does it for another book, which was itself an attempt to try to concretize halacha, but not in the same way. And this gets a little into the weeds, but the Torah. Who was the Torah? The Torah was Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim. He's called that because he wrote the Torah. Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim is unfortunately instinctively more known as the guy with the gematrias, because he writes all these commentaries to the Chumash, that this is, you know, the same gematria as this thing, whatever. But he was much more influential in what he wrote as the Torah. The Torah, and Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim, by the way, is the son of the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher. Now, what's interesting about being the son of the Rush? As we said, the Rush left Germany to move to Spain, which means that the Rush lived some of his life in Spain, but his son lived even more of his life in Spain, right? So he has even more of a Sephardic sort of tint to him. But the Torah basically, if you wanted a wholesome but still basic view of the Gemara's discussion of halacha, or the commentary's discussion of a Gemara, so you look at the Torah. The Torah will give you different opinions of how to understand a certain law. But the difference between the Torah and other breakdowns of the Gemara is he doesn't give you the conclusion. The Torah very rarely tells you, this is what we have to do. Very often what he'll say is, this is what my father did, the Rush. So it's basically an explanation of his father's practices, but without a sort of a concrete conclusion. Rabbi Yosef Kairo comes along, and the way he did it, the reason he's called the Torah, a Torah is a pillar or a column. So the Torah, he does the Arba Balaturim, right? The Arba Turim, the four columns. Sorry, what happened there? Is everyone still with me? Good? Okay. So he writes the Balaturim, and the Torah is basically four columns, right? If we could
write it down.
Hello, what did I do?
We can't hear you.
You can't hear me?
I didn't do anything.
Stop. You're good now. You're good now.
I'm good now? Okay.
You're good.
Okay, I can hear him. Okay, this
thank you guys. I didn't know someone had chimed in there. So, okay. So back to the tour. So the tour is broken up into four sections, four columns, four pillars, if you will. I had an architecture teacher that once told me that in architecture, those big things that hold other things up are not called pillars. Those are columns. Pillars are figurative. Columns are physical. I don't know how true that is, but either way, he wrote four pillars. And these are four pillars of halacha, right? These are the four building blocks, foundations of the four categories of halacha. First, you have perhaps the most focus on is Orach Chaim. Orach Chaim is the way of life. It talks about daily living. It talks about halachos of when you wake up in the morning, how you daven Shemona Esrei, how do you keep Shabbos, how do you keep Pesach, all the halachos that come up, naturally that come up. They're not circumstantial, but they're inevitable, right? So that's Orach Chaim, the way of life. The second pillar, although I don't know if this is the right order, second pillar is Yoredeya. Probably the second most focused on Yoredeya is the concepts of Isser V'Heter. How do you shecht an animal? What happens when milk and meat mix? Bris Milah, Biker Cholim, Avelis, all of those are in Yoredeya. Circumstantial Isser V'Heter type things. Another one, a third pillar is Evan Ha'ezer. Evan Ha'ezer, all about relationships, types of relationships you can have, types of relationships you shouldn't have. And then the fourth column is Choshen Mishpat, which is about damages and civil law, right? Someone steals from you, you have to return an object, things like that. So those four columns are very, even though the Torah writes about all of them, and therefore they're very explanatory and they're very comprehensive, there's one thing that the Torah does which is very different from what the Rambam did. The Torah basically took the commentaries and the analysis from the Gemara beforehand and made it very practical. And perhaps the most fundamental way that he made it practical, he cut out everything that doesn't apply anymore in our day. That doesn't apply in our day. Meaning what? Everything about the Beis HaMikdash, cut it out. The Rambam has everything about the Beis HaMikdash. He talks about karbanos, and he talks about, you know, impurity and the ramifications of those things. But when the Torah comes along in the 14th century, he says, let's focus on the practical stuff. So in a way, the Torah is trying to bring it home to a more practical, bottom line type of thing. What do we have to do nowadays? But at the same time, he didn't go all the way. He didn't go all the way to actually give us a real conclusion. So when Rabbi Yosef Karo looks at the Torah, so he thinks, let me do another commentary. Because the Torah, although he went pretty far, pretty expansive in his conversation, it didn't go far enough. So Rabbi Yosef Karo writes the Beis Yosef, this is presumably while he's already in Sfat, although unclear. Not sure if he did or not. Unclear. He definitely wrote wrote the Kesef Mishnah beforehand, and that preceded him. People knew about him already when he lived at Tzfat, because he had written that already. But the Beis Yosef, the commentary on the Torah, was much more expansive. Even though it only wrote about practical stuff, the Kesef Mishnah is a little bit more concise in that he's just defending the Rambam. This is where he got it from. This is the explanation. He was the bridge between the Gemara and the Rambam. Now the Beis Yosef gets a little bit more into not only explaining the background for something, but also giving you his personal opinion as to what to do. He's a little older. He's answering people's shailas. So he's already sort of grown accustomed to giving over his opinion on halacha, especially now that he's in a community, etc. So in the Beis Yosef, he sort of combines what he did in the Kesef Mishnah in that it explains things. It explains the commentaries. It explains the background for what the Torah is talking about. But then, as opposed to what the Torah did, the Beis Yosef will tell you, this is what I think we should do. Right? After his whole analysis, his whole explanation, yeah, at the end of it, he says, this is what we should do. And because of that, he sort of, he grows in his reputation as being more of a halacha decisor, as opposed to just an explainer, as opposed to just the analysis guy, right? Just not just the analyzer, but also the conclusion. He starts to dabble in conclusions. Now, meanwhile, there's a character in Poland And his name is Rav Moshe Isserles. Now, Rav Moshe Isserles himself wasn't... let me think about this for a second. I don't think he was... I think he was younger than Rabbi Yosef Karo. Let me just look it up for a second before I say something I'll regret. Rav Moshe Isserles was born in 1530. So he's 40 years younger. He dies about the same time as Rabbi Yosef Karo, but he's 40 years younger than Rabbi Yosef Karo. Rav Moshe Isserles comes up with the same kind of theory, that he's going to come along and explain the Torah. And he writes a commentary called the Darkei Moshe. The Darkei Moshe is also an explanation. There's a long one, there's a short one. He actually writes two, but either way. And in this Darkei Moshe, it also does a similar thing to what Rabbi Yosef Karo did. But as opposed to Rabbi Yosef Karo, who's predominantly Sephardic, Rav Moshe Isserles is from Poland. And he writes his conclusions and what he thinks is the proper practical law. He writes it with an Ashkenazic conclusion. So it's fascinating. You have these two figures from different parts of the world, both trying to do the same thing, explain and give people background, but also the conclusions about how we should rule and how we should follow, both as a commentary to the Torah, which is trying to be practical. I know this is a lot of information, but it's all going to come together because Rabbi Yosef Karo comes along and says, this Beis Yosef is great. It gives a lot of background. It gives a lot of explanation. It even gives conclusions to people. The problem is not everyone is a Talmud Chacham. Not everyone could pick up a Torah and a Beis Yosef and read through the whole thing and understand all the Gemaras and all the analysis and all the commentaries and where I got my conclusion from. Instead, I have to write another book. And people didn't like this. People didn't like specifically because of this idea that not only is he thinking of accommodating for the non-Talmud Chacham, for what we'll call the simpleton, he's also therefore encouraging it by writing a new book, which he calls the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, as we call it, the Shulchan Aruch, is literally means the set table, right? The set table, the table is basically set. What does it mean, the set table? It's all laid out for you. You don't have to get any food from the pantry. You don't have to bring your own cutlery. You don't have to get your own cups or plates. Everything is set out for you. Rabbi Yosef Karo's hope and his objective when he wrote the Shulchan Aruch was people would be able to look at it in a very concise and organized manner and know what they're supposed to do. This is what you do. And if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, I just had one. I don't know where I put it. Let me get from the other room. Hold on. I'm back. Stop misbehaving. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch, so you'll find here, there are a lot of words. A lot of words. But where is the actual Shulchan Aruch? Only this little box. That's all Rabbi Yosef Karo wanted to say. Keeping it simple, keeping it concise. All of this is commentary. Everyone else is trying to figure out what Rabbi Yosef Karo is doing. So just like Rabbi Yosef Karo, when he looked at the Rambam, he said, we need to backtrack to give more explanation. When he looked at the Torah, we have to backtrack, give more explanation, more background, give a conclusion. That's what everybody else is now doing to Rabbi Yosef Karo. But Rabbi Yosef Karo's whole point was, there should be a book that you don't need all the explanation. There should be a book which is just concise and gives you the bottom line conclusions of all of these conversations. So that's why he writes the Shulchan Aruch. Meanwhile, in Poland, Rav Moshe Isserles is thinking the same exact thing. He's thinking, we need a more concise book. And apparently, legend has it that Rav Moshe Isserles also wrote a Shulchan Aruch. But then someone told him, you know that Beis Yosef, you know that Rabbi Yosef Karo, who already beat you to the punch when it came to the explanation of the Torah, he beat you to the punch on this idea too. And he also wrote a Shulchan Aruch. Now Rav Moshe Isserles, we've talked about this before in our Shabbos afternoon shir, Rav Moshe Isserles had a choice. He could either publish another Shulchan Aruch, which I guess they would call something else, Shulchan Aruch of the Ramah. I don't know what he was going to call it. Or he could partner with the Beis Yosef. Now, there wasn't a literal partnership, but Rav Moshe Isserles basically decides that instead of writing his own codification of law, he's going to take the Shulchan Aruch of Rav Yosef Cairo, and he's going to add his own opinion afterwards. And therefore, let me find a good page that shows this. I don't have the clearest Shulchan Aruch, but if you see here, you have some dark, bigger letters. That's the Shulchan Aruch. And then underneath it, you have smaller, I guess, Rashi script letters. And this is the Ramah. The Shulchan Aruch, this is Rabbi Yosef Cairo, saying what he wants to say. And underneath, the Ramah says, actually, here in Poland, we do it a little differently. Right? So instead of just having this as one book, and this as a second book, Rav Moshe Isserles takes his book, the Shulchan Aruch, and adds his own commentary to it instead. Now, the reason this is so important, at least the way that I like to think about it, the reason this is so important is because it brought the entire Jewish world to be on the same page. Much like Daf Yomi, right? Everyone's on the same page. For the Shulchan Aruch, everyone, whether you're Ashkenaz or whether you're Sephard, decided to use the Shulchan Aruch. The reason I say it that way is because there were other books that were not as popular as the Shulchan Aruch that were trying to do the same thing. The Levush, Rabbi Mordechai Yaffe, wrote a Shulchan Aruch. He called it the Levush, that's what it's called. But the difference between the Levush and the Shulchan Aruch was, first of all, the Levush was much more explanatory, which was one of his, he was one of those proponents of why the Shulchan Aruch was a bad thing, because it discouraged people from learning. You didn't need to know the Gemaras anymore. You didn't need to know the commentaries anymore. The Levush wrote a book that included all those commentaries. It was much more expansive. It was much more explanatory, and people didn't want to read it as much. But also because it was only Ashkenazic. I'm pretty sure the Levush was Ashkenazic. Because it was only Ashkenazic, so it didn't take up... It didn't... Czechoslovakia. Prague. So it didn't take up as much of the world's attention because he was only Ashkenazic. Whereas Rabbi Yosef Cairo, being the Sephardi, and the Ramah, being the Ashkenazi, really brought the worlds together. And anyone, whether you were Sephardic or Ashkenazic, was not only reading the Shulchan Aruch, but was also commenting on it. And that's why there's so many commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, but there are very few commentaries on the Levush. So this is sort of Rabbi Yosef Cairo's pinnacle of his monumental work, the Shulchan Aruch.
Wasn't what the Ramah wrote called the Mapa?
Yeah. So literally, he called it the Mapa because it went over the Shulchan Aruch. It was like a cute little name where the Shulchan Aruch wrote his thing and he added his own thing on top. Very good. Yeah. I should have mentioned that. So that's the Shulchan Aruch. And as I said before, one of the other possible critiques of the Shulchan Aruch is that it's very Sephardic, right? The Levush didn't like because it was Sephardic, meaning that Rabbi Yosef Cairo writes in the introduction to this book, he writes, you know, we need a concise book, etc., that's going to give us just the bottom line. So who am I going to base it on? There are so many commentaries, there are so many rabbis, there are so many things to look at. So who am I going to base it on? He says, I'm going to base it on three things, three people. The three codifiers that came before me, the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. The only problem is, as we said before, 2.5 of those three are Sephardic. And he says, whenever they disagree, I'm going to go with the majority, which means 80% of it is strictly Sephardic. The only 20% is the Rush's Ashkenazic views that he kept holding on to at the end of his life. And therefore, some people didn't like it for that. And there's another, some people say that there's another problem, which is that that he didn't really include a lot of Tosfos. In his introduction, he says, I'm going to base it on these three people, but he doesn't base it on Tosfos. Tosfos are Ashkenazic, and they also come to conclusions about Halacha very often, but he didn't consider those to be into the equation, for one reason or another. Either way, Rabbi Yosef Cairo writes this book in Sfat. We'll read it inside soon, to get a little bit of a flavor for how that works. But to just give a little bit more background into who Rabbi Yosef Cairo was as a person, although this is also something we can't delve into too much. Rabbi Yosef Cairo, when he moves to Tzfat, becomes part of a cadre of rabbis that are known for what Tzfat's known for, which is mysticism. Anyone who's been to Tzfat knows there's light blue everywhere. That's Kabbalistic, that's mysticism. There's a lot of interesting history about Tzfat. What's interesting about Tzfat is actually that there's very little, geographic significance. Despite it being a very holy place, we don't find it in Tanakh anywhere. It might be mentioned in the Gemara, but only by reference. It's not one of these long-standing Jewish cities like Hebron or Yerushalayim or you know other places. So it's interesting, or Tveria. So for one reason or another, people settle in Tzfat. Some people think it might have been a financial thing, the Ottoman government allowed it, whatever. But what's that? Sorry. Can you hear me? Good? No? Yes? Yes, we're good? Okay, I'm getting the thumbs up now. So either way, he settles in Tzfat, and he ultimately becomes part of this group of rabbis, which are very Kabbalistic. So people like Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, people might know Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, he tries to create a Sanhedrin, because what basically happens is a lot of very prominent rabbis that you already know about, the Alshech, Rav Moshe Alshech, Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, the Arizal ultimately is there, but he comes a little later. All these prominent rabbis are in Tzfat, and they want to create a Sanhedrin. There's so many prominent rabbis, we should do something together. Happens to be that those prominent rabbis were also very prominent Kabbalistic rabbis, and therefore they had little groups of little Kabbalistic, I don't exactly know what they did, but we have documentation of their conversations. People might be familiar with the fact that our custom to stay up, to stay awake Shavuos night, comes from Rabbi Yosef Cairo and this little group of rabbis who decided they had to stay up. Interestingly enough, I think the story goes that they, for Shavuos night, they had 9 of those rabbis together, and the next morning they saw the 10th one, and they saw one of the others that wasn't there with them, and they basically said, oh, you should have been there, it's a shame you weren't there, because if we would have had a minion, it could have been even better. And there was like this whole story of Rabbi Yosef Cairo, that this voice, this heavenly voice, spoke from Rabbi Yosef Cairo's mouth, and it was this unbelievable spiritual experience. There are a lot of different versions of it, but doesn't matter exactly the details for now. Maybe Shavuos, we can talk about it. But so I think they stayed up the next night also, with all 10 of them, and it was the same thing, whatever. But the legends have, and the Rabbi Yosef Cairo writes a book based on it, the Magid Meisharim, or at least people wrote a book based on it. He speaks to angels in these spiritual Kabbalistic sessions. They have communication with angels, and he writes much of it down. Some of it has halachic, some of it is mystical, but he writes some of it down, and a lot of people wonder how much of that Kabbalistic sense that Rabbi Yosef Cairo developed in Tzfat, how much of that seeped into the Shulchan Aruch? And the truth is, you don't find it very often. Rabbi Yosef Cairo had what seems to be a very keen ability to compartmentalize his Kabbalistic and halachic mind. Whereas he had his analysis of the Gemara, of the commentaries, of the previous codifiers, and he kept it to those things in order to dictate the law. Other times in his life, he would do the Kabbalah thing, the mysticism thing, but the two really didn't mix together. Although it's very interesting to try to figure out, there are some times in Shulchan Aruch people sort of throw their hands up and they're like, where did he get this from? And many times it is from Kabbalah. And the general rule is, and I think even the Beis Yosef hints to this at one point, if I remember correctly, in Hilchos Kriyas HaTorah, about how to get an Aliyah and what things to do, I think he says there, the rule of thumb is, if there's a Kabbalistic practice which in no way is contradictory to any Gemara, so then he'll include it in the Shulchan Aruch, or he'll feel he'll feel free to include in the Shulchan Aruch. But if it's in any way contradictory to halachos and discussions of the Gemara, so then he won't include it. So that's why there are sometimes interesting discussions among the commentaries. Why did he include this Kabbalah concept? Isn't it against the Gemara over here? But not for us right now. But interesting to know that he, for the most part, kept the two things separate, but he did sometimes bring in the Kabbalah into the Shulchan Aruch. But you can tell from just that dichotomy of his character, what kind of deep thinker he was, what kind of deep character he had, to be able to not only be an expert in the field of halacha and of Gemara, but also to be an expert in the field of Kabbalah. It's from him that I think one of his, where did I read this? Maybe it's in my notes. Let me give me a second. Not entirely sure. Yeah, I have in my notes. I don't know if this is true or not. I don't know. These are old notes. I didn't confirm all of it. But I have in my notes that one of his daughters married the Arizal. Is that possible? Not sure. Either way, his students were definitely rabbis of the Arizal. So the timing works out. One of his major students was the Radvaz, who was a Rebbe to the Arizal, the Arizal being the one who the rabbi who basically created Kabbalah in its modern form. Not created, but renovated or paraphrased it in terms that we can understand for the masses, for better and for worse, unfortunately. But this all comes from Rabbi Yosef Kara. And Rabbi Yosef Kara, when you look at his kever in Sfat, you'll notice it's also painted light blue, right? Just like the other light blue kvarim, the other light blue grave sites over there in Sfat, collected with all those other very well known rabbis. And because he was a Kabbalist, but his greatest influence on Jewish history was clearly, at least in the revealed world, his greatest influence was certainly through his Shulchan Aruch, was through the codification of law. And in order to get so ultimately, let's just finish off his life. He dies at the age of 87, which is pretty, you know, given that he had two wives, at least two wives and three children that died. The fact that he could live to 87 is you know, very impressive. Very outstanding for that time, especially given the fact that the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Israelis, died at the age of, what did I just see? He was like in his 40s. Born 40 years after, but died 3 years before Rabbi Yosef Kara. So it's just a note to the times about what kinds of things you had to be careful about. Rabbi Yosef Kara died at the age of 87, buried in Sfat, as we just said. And he's known basically as the Kabbalist, but also known as the Mechaber. The Mechaber means the author. The author is a reference to the fact that he wrote the Shulchan Aruch. People call him the Mechaber. If you ever find a Sephardi talking about the Shulchan Aruch, they might call him Maran. Everyone ever heard the phrase Maran, which means our master? Right, because Shulchan Aruch is basically giving over Sephardi Psak. And when the Rama says something, the Sephardis just look at the top part. They don't really think about the Rama too much. But it is interesting, especially when it comes to Pesach time, what things can you borrow from one person to the other? But we'll leave that to another discussion, probably not in the middle of a shir. But the Shulchan Aruch, interestingly enough, has, as we said, its roots in the Beis Yosef and the Kasef Mishnah. So just one quick example of that to get a feel for it. I don't know if anyone else noticed that I put in the chat a sheet here that maybe you could click on. I will repost it for anyone. I think sometimes if you don't get it originally, you have to get it once you're in the group also. So there it is again. Hopefully you can open it up. So this is a source sheet about a very simple halacha that we have. About Pesach. And I was just working today on the calendar for Pesach to just let people know how Pesach goes and how you know, the different requirements to do. So the question becomes, especially when we're davening alone, unfortunately, in our homes for Pesach, so when can you start the Seder? Ready you left Stetzer, right? The Seder is this long, drawn-out thing. You want the kids to stay up for it, but unfortunately, it gets very late. So can you start the Seder early? So the question becomes, well, what has to be done after Tzeis, once it gets dark? So if you look at the first source here, you'll see a Gemara at the beginning of a parak called Arve Pesachim, which talks mostly about how we think of Pesach, right? Seder night. You'll see the Mishnah tells us, Erev Pesachim Samach L'mincha Lo Yochal Adam Ancha Techshach. When it gets too late on Erev Pesach, meaning next Wednesday, you don't want to be eating after Mincha time, right? You want to be hungry for the Seder, right? So Lo Yochal Adam Ancha Techshach, you're not allowed to eat until it gets dark, meaning you can't start your Seder until it gets dark. Well, we'll get there in a second. Right, the literal words are lo yochal ad shetechshach. You cannot eat until it gets dark. Afilu ani shebi Yisrael lo yochal ad sheyasev. Even a poor person shouldn't eat until he reclines. Lo yifchasu lo me'arba kosos. And a poor person shouldn't have less than 4 cups of wine. Vafilu minatamcha, even if he has to take it from charity. Why shouldn't you eat? Why shouldn't you eat before Pesach comes in? Says Rashi in source number 2, Lo yochal kedei sheyochal matzah shel mitzvah l'te'avon, so that you can eat the matzah, which is a mitzvah, with a thirst, with a hunger. Rashi, a very fascinating application of this concept coming up. Mishum hidur mitzvah. Why should you be hungry for the matzah? So that it's beautifying the mitzvah. It's an interesting application of that, not for now, for a different time. Usually when we talk about hidra mitzvah, we mean like a beautiful esrog, right? Or a beautiful Torah cover. Here, there's a hidr, there's a beautification of the mitzvah when you really want to eat the matzah, right? I really want to eat it. Interestingly enough, when it comes to the Karban Pesach, you're not allowed to be hungry for it because you don't want to be too ravenous and break the bones, which is an isser. Either way. Here's one of the characters we talked about, the Tor, Rav Yaakov Baal Turim, the son of the Rush, says the following. When he codifies this halach, he says, V'yeh shulchanu aruch mi ba'od yom, the table should be set from before the day starts, k'dei l'achol miyad k'she techshach, so that you can eat the Seder, you can start it right away. Now notice the words that he uses, k'dei l'achol miyad k'she techshach, so that you can eat right away. Now that's interesting. When do we eat in the Seder? The first time we eat is probably Karpas. But if you wanted to maybe start a little early, what could you do? You could have Kiddush. You could do Karpas later. And you have so much to do. You have so much to do until you get to the Matzah. Right? As Rashi says, the whole point is the Matzah. The whole point is that Matzah should be eaten later. Right? After it gets dark. So how long does it take us to get to the matzah? I don't know about you guys, but for me, you know, I don't know what it's going to be like this year, but for me, it could take 2-3 hours until you get to matzah. It could take a long time to get through all of Magid until you get to the matzah. It could take a long time. And therefore, one could ask the question, one could imply from the Torah that maybe let's say Kiddush first, just like we have Kiddush early on a Shabbos Friday night. We could have Kiddush first, and then we'll eat the matzah 2 hours from now. Let's take in Pesach early. Let's take it in at 6 o'clock. And then by 8 o'clock, we'll be ready for the matzah. I don't know if that even works here in Detroit. But either way, you get my point. Right? So the Torah says, V'afim hu birkas hamazon, yakum mishum shemitzvah lemar lechol b'shvilat tinokos. I don't know what that word is. Forgot.
Maybe it is Beis HaMedrash.
Yeah, you're right. I think it means that if somebody's learning and you're doing something worthwhile, so even if you're learning, yakum mishum shemitzvah lemar lechol b'shvilat tinokos, you should go home and eat with your family so that the kids at least have a chance to take part in the Seder. Shelo yishnu, that they don't fall asleep. Aval, however, lo yochal kodem shetechshach, don't eat lechol lo yochal kodem shetechshach before it gets dark. Af agav, even though. And this is a paraphrase of the Gemara also. Even though you're allowed to start other Yom Tovs early, Pesach Shani, Pesach is different. Dezman achilas matzah enu ela belaila dumi de Pesach. The time to eat matzah is only after it gets dark, similar to the Pesach. Why is that? So comes the Beis Yosef. Who's the Beis Yosef? This is Rabbi Yosef Karo's commentary on the Torah. Again, more expansive, more explanatory. This is source number 4. Aval lo yochal kol mishdach shavakdim shavas shabasos v'yomitov v'chom l'hosim v'chol l'kosh Pesach shani yizman achilas matzah eno ela b'layah. He's just quoting. V'chul v'kein kasev harash. Right? That makes sense. The Torah is quoting his father. Bereish perak arvi p'sachim. Lo yochal adam ashetech shach tema. Says the Beis Yosef, it's a wonderment. Amai tana ashetech shach tvemi b'erav shabasos v'yomitovim. Why is it that Pesach is different specifically as opposed to the other times like Shabbos and Yom Tov? Yesh lomar de'asa la'ashmeinan. It's coming to tell us afagat Shabbos Yom Tov yachol host mechol hakodesh v'lechol kol mishtach shach kedar min parak tefilas hashachar. Even though the Gemara in Brachos, right, this is his explanation. This is the Beis Yosef. This is what he does for the Torah. He goes into the background. There's a Gemara in Brachos that says that be'erev Pesach lo matzi achol ad shetach shach. You can't eat until it gets dark. V'chein mash v'yirshami. It's not nami l'kaman. Ha Pesach eno necha elo b'layla. You can't eat the carbon Pesach unless it's already nighttime. U'matza iskish l'Pesach. And matza is connected to the Pesach. Meaning, why? It's connected through a juxtaposition in the Pasuk. Dichsiv al matzo sumurorim yochluhu. Adkan Lashonu, he's quoting from the Rush, that basically, there's a juxtaposition in the Pasuk, that when you eat the Karban Pesach, you eat the Paschal lamb, it should be done in conjunction with matzah and maror. Much like Hillel says on the Seder night. Right, Kain asa Hillel b'zman sebeish ben haikayim. This is what Hillel used to do. He used to sort of make them all into a sandwich, right? So ene lechav v'chein kasav gam kain v'perak tchelos tefilas hashachar v'kasav b'tosos. No, not tosos. B'kasav b'trumas hadeshen. Another early achron. B'trumas hadeshen de'afa gav to kodem sheisayim haigada v'yagil lechol matzah mari yelai lamamish. Even though, before you finish Magid, before you finish the Haggadah, by that time it's going to be a time to eat matzah and maror, right? This is his implicit question. Why can't you start Kiddush early? Yielai lamash mikol makom. Kos shel Kiddush shehu echar mi'arba kosos. The first cup of the four cups, the Kiddush, has to be v'gam achil ha'shar yirakos v'yeser shinuyim ta'avdinim kiddush yishel ha'tinokos, and all the other things that we do for the sake of the children asking and being part of the Seder, v'kol shegein ha'agad ha'atzma, and certainly the Magid itself, bayi nami delehave b'shah shirayu l'achol matzah maror. Those mitzvahs also have to take place at the same time you're eating, that you could eat matzah and maror. This interesting is an interesting Ramban that talks about how the mitzvah of matzah is connected to the mitzvah of saying Magid. Not going to talk about it. Sibur Yisias Mitzrayim. Not going to talk about it now. But says the Truma Sedeshin, quoted from the Rama. Right, this is where the Rama is basically explaining things. Right, he's bringing in his halacha that we said before. He's explaining the background, and then he says, by the way, this also applies to Kiddush. Don't read the. Thanks, Steve. Don't read the Torah and think that the background implies you only have to eat once it gets dark. You also have to have Kiddush once it gets dark. You can't have Kiddush before it gets dark because it's part and parcel of the mitzvot of Pesach. And therefore, now that we know the Beis Yosef, we know Rabbi Yosef Karo's thinking about this, let's look at how he says it in the Shulchan Aruch. Yeah, Shulchano Aruch mi ba'od yom kedei lechol miyad sheketashach. He says the same lashon as the Torah. V'af imhu bebeis medrash. Even if you're in learning in shul, yachlum v'nish mitzvah l'mayar v'lechol b'shvel tinokos shul yishnu, and that you shouldn't sleep. Aval lo yomar kiddush al shetech shach. Right? He adds that sort of caveat at the end, which the Torah didn't have, which the Gemara didn't have, which Rashi didn't talk about. Right, nobody talked about this until the Beis Yosef came along. And all of a sudden, if you were just to open up a Shulchan Aruch and you were to read the words of the Shulchan Aruch, you'd think that this is sort of like the long-standing halacha from all of Jewish history. You have to make Kiddush after it's dark. But who says so? The only way you would ever know it is if you looked at the commentary of the Beis Yosef on the Torah. which explains that there's a juxtaposition not only from matzah to the Pesach, which requires you to eat it at night, but there's also a connection between the mitzvahs of Dalad Kosos, the four cups, and including Kiddush, and the mitzvah of matzah, and the mitzvahs of the night of Pesach. So if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, it's just going to give you the basic bottom line, eat once it gets dark, but also say Kiddush once it gets dark, but you wouldn't know where it comes from unless you go back into the Beis Yosef, you go back into the commentary and explanation of Rabbi Yosef Karo. So that's just a quick, practical example of what Rabbi Yosef Karo did, the monumental efforts that he did, and how it literally, today, I was deciding what number, what time to put on the information bulletin for Pesach. I looked at Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says, once it gets dark, that's what you have to do. And that's become the halacha. No one disagrees with that. It's black and off-white in the Shulchan Aruch, so we follow that. That's what we do, because Rabbi Yosef Karo said so. So these are the types of things Rabbi Yosef Karo has done for us. Made it very simple, very boiled down. If you want more explanation, you go into the Beis Yosef, you go back into the Gemara, you understand all these things of the Gemara and Brachos, the Gemara and Arvei Pesachim, you put them all together, but Rabbi Yosef Karo does it for us. He gives us the bottom line. And I can't stress enough, the impact of Rabbi Yosef Karo is literally felt every day across the world, whether it's through his commentary on the Rambam, or his commentary on the Torah, or obviously, most notably, his actual codification of law in the Shulchan Aruch. And therefore, it's a pleasure for us, before we go into a day like Pesach, I'm unmuting you all, before we go into a day like Pesach, which is so instrumental and is so vast with all the halachos that are relevant for the holiday, we have to appreciate a little bit where many of those halachas come from, and it's from Yosef Karo. So that's a little bit of the legend of Yosef Karo, that's a little of the lessons of Yosef Karo, and hopefully with that, we can go into Pesach understanding where much of our halachos and much of the minhagim that we'll be observing ultimately came from. Okay, thank you all for joining me. Great crowd tonight, and Mirza Hashem.
Hey, Rabbi.
Yeah, you have a question, Evan?
I have a Shulchan Aruch that I picked up years ago, but it's Rabbi Schneur Zalman, so where does he...
Yeah, that's a different Shulchan Aruch. That's okay. Called the Shulchan Aruch Harav. And that's basically... Okay. That's basically Schneur Zalman of Liadi's paraphrasing of some halachos, but also his additions with Hasidic minhagim and things like that that aren't always followed by everybody, but much of it is in line with the Gemara and Poskim too.
How does the Aruch HaShulchan fit in?
The Aruch HaShulchan is basically a commentary that goes through step by step with a little more background. It's interesting. He's got more explanation and background, but it's also in a very organized way. So, because he splits it up into paragraphs. Oh, yeah. He's in the 19th century. Much later. He's the father of the Torah Tumimah, who I think even lived in America for a little bit. Yeah.
It's interesting that they make the comparison between the matzah and the Korban Pesach as far as when you can eat them.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the matzah, they say you have to eat b'te'avon, and the Korban Pesach, you weren't allowed to eat b'te'avon.
Right. I think that's... you remember there are two separate mitzvahs.
Right.
Although, if you literally eat them together... So then you'd be right. It would be a good question. But I think when the Pasuk says it literally, it means you eat it with matzah, like at the same meal. I don't think it's literally like the sandwich, but that's what Hillel says. So right. The question becomes, was Hillel yotze his mitzvah of matzah and Karban Pesach in that same sandwich? I don't know. It's a good question. I'm not sure. That I do not know. But if he did, then it would be a good question. Because you have a problem eating the Karban Pesach fast, but you have an obligation to eat it on an empty stomach for matzah. So I don't know. Good question. But thank you all for joining us. And Mirz Hashem, we should have a Chag Kasher Ubari V'Sameach. Kosher, healthy, and enjoyable Pesach. Amen. Everyone should be well. Have a good night. Amen. Stay safe.
Amen. Thank you, Rabbi.
Of course, be well. Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye.